Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ's Ag Edge Network for their help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, we will meet our three hosts and learn a little bit about them and their thoughts on issues facing agriculture. Our topic of the week will be soil testing and why it's important, and we will wrap things up with this week's timely tips. As always, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, good morning. Jay, how are you?
Doing good. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing real well today, real well.
A little bit cold this morning, wasn't it?
It's a little bit chilly. Got the mules all taken care of last night. My wife's mules, I mean, preface all that. She has two mules that she rides. And so we got the ice all squared away, put the tank heater in the stock tank, and didn't have any ice. So that's a good morning. When she's happy, it's always good.
that is a good day, isn't it? What is it they say? When mama's happy, everybody's happy.
Right. And I'll just go ahead and say that is 100% true. So you fellas need to remember that. That is a very true statement.
First-hand knowledge there. Well, we're going to start this week with giving a little bit of a bio and a little bit of description on our host. We've got three hosts for this show. David Ferquin is the ag agent in McLean County, Kentucky. Vicki Shadricks, the ag agent in Webster County, Kentucky. And I'm Jay Stone. I'm the ag agent in Hopkins County, Kentucky. Our three counties join here, and we do a lot of work together, do a lot of programming together, and decided this show would be a good way to get some information out to folks, all folks, but especially some of those non-traditional clientele that don't just make it into our office every day. So,
I agree 100%. This is hopefully is going to be a new way to reach a part of our clientele that we don't normally get to talk to very often, and they can understand more about agriculture and about what we're doing in the extension office and in the ag industry.
Well, and, you know, as I pointed out in that introduction, this isn't an ag-related show. It is for producers, but we hope it to be equally informative for consumers as well. That's an important relationship between producers and consumers, and I think it's important that both sides are educated. One, you know, when the consumer's happy, kind of like mama, when the consumer's happy, everybody can be happy. When the consumer's not, it's going to reflect in sales. So I think it's very important to maintain that relationship and further that relationship between producers and consumers.
And I think we all realize, too, that everybody seems to be busy all the time. And I think this is just a great way to be able to learn something, for us to be able to get information out, for folks to be able to learn something, but it's not slowing you down. You're not having to come in somewhere. You're doing that when you're driving from point A from point A to B. And I just think that's a great way to do business, so to speak.
Yeah. And you know, and folks knowing where their food comes from and how their food is produced is so important these days. I mean, we can't do enough education when it comes to that whatsoever. So
no, I agree. Exactly right. I think we hear a lot right now about local foods. That's kind of the buzzwords. And I think the term local foods and that growth and that movement is a direct result in consumers wanting to be informed. That shows that they're hungry for more than just local vegetables. They're hungry for information.
Sure.
They're
right.
Wanting to know where that food comes from and know where their information comes from, and we hope to be one of those sources of information. So
that's right.
David, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I grew up on a family farm there in Gracie, Kentucky. We have cattle, tobacco, forages, row crops. We got about 60 brood cows that my father, myself, and my son are partners on. My grandkids are the sixth generation to work that farm, and I have a bachelor's in ag business and a master's in animal science, and I've been working in the ag industry for a total of 34 years, 17 as an ag extension agent. So, you know, my background is a little bit of production agriculture as well as ag retail. So I've kind of had the whole gamut of experience, to be quite honest with you. So hopefully that'll help as we continue this show and try to educate folks.
Absolutely. Certainly sounds like you're qualified to be sitting in the chair, so to speak.
I hope so.
Vicki, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I grew up on a farm in a little town of Dixon, Kentucky. It is a very small place, but it is a special place, or at least I think it is anyway. But my dad and my uncle farmed together, and basically a corn, soybeans, tobacco. My dad had a little cattle, but by the time I got up big enough to really pay any attention much, they were already gone. That wasn't what he enjoyed. And on that line, my earliest memories of being on the farm was pulling tobacco plants and chopping out tobacco. And somehow my dad would drop me off to pull tobacco plants and he'd leave. So, you know, I don't know what he was doing, but that was what happened. So
other more important.
There was other important things that he needed to do. And so I got to do that. And he'd always say, no, make sure you count them plants. So
I think they call that management.
I think he was in a management position and I was on an entry level position, but that's okay. I learned a lot from that. So, but my passion, or maybe that's not the right word, but what I really enjoy is plant and soil science. That's kind of where I really enjoy. And that's what my degree is in, agronomy. And I really enjoy that, but my master's is actually in animal science because I felt like I wanted to learn more about other areas of agriculture other than plant and soil science, where I was very, you know, specific in that early on. And so my master's is in that. And so I've been able to use both of those degrees in the last 21 years that I've been an extension agent here in Webster County. And previous to that, I was a crop consultant for about 6.5 years. So had a lot of experience in that field too. So I am glad to be a part of this. And I think that it's going to be fun for us. And I think it's going to be fun for our listeners too.
I think you're right. And I'll just follow up and talk a little bit about myself. I've been an extension agent for going on 27 years. Prior to that, started off much different than the two of you in the fact that my family left the farm a couple of generations before I came along. I came from a family of part-time farmers who always had off-farm employment, mostly in the labor force, mostly working in factories. And once I was to the point of getting out on my own, I followed along and did the same thing. Went to work for a factory, had 27 head of mama cows, David, and about 5 acres of burley tobacco. And
that's a plenty.
That was enough. And our family had a broodmare operation. It was my uncle, my dad, and my grandfather. We bred and boarded horses for people and stood several studs at stud. And basically, just worked and lived. And I was quite happy doing that and quite happy with my off-farm employment and my on-farm way of life, which I really enjoyed until NAFTA came along and sent my job to Honduras. And you can't make it anywhere anymore with 27 mama cows and 5 acres of tobacco.
You'd still spend a lot of money, though.
That's right. So that's the point where I decided to leave and go to college. I got a degree in animal science with my background in livestock production. I think that kind of suited me. And then my master's is actually in agribusiness, David. I was exactly opposite of what you did. But like I said, I've been with Extension for almost 27 years, and I feel like my education and my experience on the farm and working for other farmers has kind of well-rounded me for that role.
Yeah, so about 65 years of total experience sitting around this table. So hopefully we'll be able to help folks, and that's what we aim to do, is to help folks and educate them about ag and those type of things.
That's right. Absolutely.
We've talked about all of our backgrounds that qualify us for this podcast and for Extension, but I think you touched on something there, helping folks. If you don't have that in your background as a willingness to want to help people, it's hard to make it in this role. I think you, as I heard years ago, you have to kindly have that servant's life and be willing to dedicate that time and effort to helping the people and helping your communities.
I think I probably something that y'all haven't done and I've done is left Extension and came back, but I left and went to work somewhere else. And when you do that and you have that attitude that you're talking about, you get to missing it. and you get to missing helping people, and you understand dealing with people every day in a retail situation or some other type of situation is different.
That's right. I can relate to that because I was in that business before I came to Extension, and I quickly learned that it's a whole different ballgame when you're not trying to sell something. It's just a different way of helping people. And over the years of my Extension time here, I've kind of said this to many people. It's an Extension way of thinking. And regardless of what role you're in Extension, whether you're like us and ag agents, or whether you're a 4-H FCS agent or a specialist, you know, we just want to help people. We want to give them the tools that they can use to make better decisions, and then therefore be more productive or be more successful or start a business or an entrepreneurship for children or whatever the case may be. That's where we really, I think that's where we shine. That's what we like to do, which is how we got this. That's what, us sitting around talking saying, hey, you guys, we should do this.
We're pretty good at sitting around and talking.
Yes, we are very good at that.
But you know, we come up with some really good ideas, and when you get together with other people and kind of do some brainstorming stuff, this is where you learn more from talking with other people than you do by being set in your ways, sitting in the office, and those type things. You know, I learn a lot more by visiting with y'all than I ever would if I just stayed in one place.
I think too, and it's, we see it, you know, when we talked about our bios. It was real evident that each one of us had a different background. Each one of us had a different, you know, what we would call our specialty, if you will, you know, where the direction we thought we was going, where our training was in, you know, whether it be agronomy or animal science or ag business or whatever, ours were all different. And so, you know, we learn stuff from each other. It's just like we hope that you all learn something from us, but we're constantly learning as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think it's probably time to move along and talk about some of this learning. You know, today there's a lot of issues that face our country and specifically face agriculture. What we plan to do every week is have just a little bit of a time where we talk about some of those issues, and we kindly divided up some different thoughts to bring to you today, and we're just going to break into those now. So, David, what's your issue to talk about this week?
Jay, mine is probably one of the hottest topics that I've talked to anybody about lately is fertilizer prices. And fertilizer in general. You know, these are some of the highest prices that we've seen in, oh gosh, maybe in forever. I can't remember it being this high. But, you know, we import, as the United States, we import somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of our potash and 27% of our nitrogen, 15% of our phosphate. You know, when you do that, you kind of limit yourself to how we can and where we can get our fertilizer. And so we're kind of at the beck and call of other folks. You know, anhydrous is up some 33%. Urea is up 16%. All fertilizer is up about 50% in 2021. I think we can see another 25 to 40% maybe for 22. You know, I don't know. We'll see. But I think those are some things that we've got to look at. So as I was reading into this, researching it, I thought, well, why is all of this? Part of it is the global natural gas shortage. Natural gas is up, in some cases, 217% over what it was normally is. And if you don't think that's exactly what they need to make nitrogen. And so that's kind of where we are on that. We have a limited amount of stockpile fertilizer that we have. The Hurricane Ida shut down the fertilizer production in Louisiana and Texas and Oklahoma, all of those places that are making fertilizer in or nitrogen fertilizer here in the States. China has suspended fertilizer exports until June of 22. And part of that is to ensure their domestic availability of that product for themselves. It's kind of amid a food security concerns that they have. I really think that part of that's going to happen here before it's all said and done. I really do. I think that's what'll happen here. DAP exports from China account for about a third of the global production. So they've shut it. They've turned the spigot off, if you will, from that standpoint. And they also account for about a tenth of the global urea production. So, and then also Russia, and then we've talked about this. We talked about this even before the show started. Russia announced their restrictions on nitrogen and phosphate starting December the 1st of this year. So, and there's some sanctions on Belarus that started in August of 21. Will continue to further the volatility in the potash market. We get a good bit of potash from them too. So, you know, those are the whys. You know, well, so people are probably sitting there going, well, what's kind of the outlook? What are we looking for? I think the urea prices, and I say I think because I've tried to research this to get some answers for folks. Urea prices are anticipated to decline in late 22, which is not going to help us any next spring whatsoever. DAP prices are going to remain elevated the first half of 22 unless the Chinese export restrictions are relaxed a little bit or something happens with them so we can increase those imports from them. And then I think potash prices are forecast to surge in 22, so it could be up even more than what it is right now. So, you know, that's kind of the outlook. It's kind of grim, I think, and kind of tough, you know. So what do we do? What's kind of some food for thought or some unanswered questions that we have? Do we have further supply chain issues? You know, are we still struggling with that? I mean, we're struggling with that, and some of the other topics we're going to cover today are going to fall right into all this stuff. What will our local availability be? You know, can our local retailers get a hold of the product to even, you know, be able to even spread on our fields? Do our corn planting intentions change? I think this is a big deal, you know. So if we, I forget what the, how many million acres, like 90 or 95 million acre, you know, if we drop back to 83, 84, you know, with soybean, you know, what happens? How does that affect the availability of nitrogen for us? Those type things, you know, and do we plant more beans? Can we change our nitrogen application strategy? You know, do we start back when I was right out of high school involved in production agriculture? You know, we were side dressing a lot. Now, understand there's lots of folks that do side dress, but there's lots of folks that put down pre-plant. Do we change that strategy? Do we start putting it down side dress? You know, how do we do that so
yeah,
we don't have to put as much?
Because we know. That's exactly that, David, that's where I was going. Because we know that when you side dress, you're going to put less units, you know, per acre, because it's a timely application where you're putting it down when the plant's going to take it up, and you don't have that time lapse there of losing the nitrogen.
You don't have to put extra.
Yeah, and you don't have to put extra because you're not putting that down pre-plant. So,
well, and because of the way our input usage has changed through the years, does some of the equipment even exist on the farm?
Yeah,
that
was another point that I was going to talk about also, or just kind of bring up. You know, do we try to put in furrow? You know, do we try to do some of that fertilizer type stuff? Do we skimp on P and K and kind of spend our money on nitrogen? You know, have we been doing a good job up until this point? Can we kind of mine a little bit of that P and K out of there? You know, what do we do? How do we strategize for that? So I think we need to order early and be ready for a disappointment, because it could happen. And we need to have a backup plan. We need to have a plan B, maybe even a C and a D.
C and D, E.
It just all depends on how things play out, but I think there's so many things that affect our prices anymore, the input prices, our commodity prices, that don't have anything to do with agriculture. And that worries me a little bit, but then also it's very unpredictable, it's very volatile, and those type things. So, you know, we'll see.
You know, from an ag retail location, as you was talking about, you know, what do we do, what's the plan of action here? You know, you and I both know that for an ag retailer, that prepay is huge for – it's big money for the retail location. That's and it's also a way for producers to be able to, in the past, have been able to capture a better price, sure, and prepay that and have some security and knowing that's already bought and paid for. And then the retailer's got the security of if you've got money coming in and he's got that product and you've got that customer.
Do you roll the dice, though? Do you roll the dice?
That's what I was
going to
say.
Go, well, I believe prices are going to go down by spring.
That's what I was going to say. How do you – I wonder how this is going to affect prepay. And, you know, from the retailer, you know, I guess from their viewpoint is can they even – I mean, you know, is it going to be a thing of you – prepay X amount of money, but that you can't put, well, then anhydrous is going to be X amount of dollars per ton. You're getting it, you're locking it in at this price because quite honestly, they may not have that price. And so how is prepay going to work? And then for producers, what you just said, are they going to roll the dice and be able to prepay, but really not know what, how much they're going to get, how much that prepay is going to go, I guess you could say.
You know, I'd have to ask the question right now if anybody was speculating that fertilizer costs are going to go down. I would want to know where their data is to suggest that. Just simply because the fact that all signs are we're in a rising market. If you look at David, you mentioned earlier our domestic nitrogen production. That's all tied to the petroleum industry. That all comes out of Southeast Texas and Louisiana. And we know that our oil production, domestic oil production, has been cut way down. We're not sending as many barrels of oil in for production, and it's part of the reason we're seeing the gas prices mm-hmm. we're seeing right now. Less gas being produced, less nitrogen being produced.
They're tied together. I agree
100%. Just a lot of uncertainty.
Well, moving along, Vicki, what's your issue for the week today?
Well, what goes right hand in hand, David, to what you were talking about, and yours is talking about the prices, and my concern is the shortage of the inputs. Are you going to have them to buy? I mean, regardless of what the price is, you know, are we going to have them?
Fertilizer being an input, but you're talking about all the other inputs that go along.
I talked to an ag retail manager, just this morning, and because I wanted to have a conversation with him about, hey, what are you hearing, or what do you think, and what are your thoughts? And I tell you, I think it's going to be tough because it's as bad as it's ever been from that standpoint. And when we start thinking about our inputs, and how we're going to manage to farm, because farmers are going to farm. That's just the way it is. Farmers are going to farm, and I think that for the most part, farmers are very innovative, which is really good when you're in a time like we are. But as far as like for seed, it looks like that seed is probably, it's not going to be too bad. I mean, I think, it's going to be out there. The seed's going to be there. Now, is it going to be more expensive to buy? Sure it is. But I think everybody, it's not going to be anything that anybody doesn't expect. And, when you were talking, I'm sure you may have looked at some things about seed and what that increase is, what you're looking at, on that.
And I think probably from that standpoint, just to interject real quick, Vicki, is that seed is probably the least of the things that are going to go up. I mean, you're looking at an 8-10% increase, which is small potatoes compared to what some of this other stuff's going up.
Well, it's the only input we've talked about so far that's almost completely produced
exactly.
Domestically.
So it's really the one of the ones that's not going to be short either, or not as short,
Maybe there's a message there.
I think you're right, Jay. But glyphosate, it's not there. And I'm afraid it's not going to be. I mean, you just go in your local, where I live, it's Rural King, but in your neck of the woods, it may be called, you may have another store such as that. But, there's been a limit on how much Roundup you can buy now for probably a month, would y'all say?
I've seen the sign.
You've seen the sign. So, there is, you know, when your local Rural Kings or Tractor Supplies or whatever the case may be, you know,
Southern States, you know, they're limiting the glyphosate.
Even the generic, not the Roundup, but the generic.
And so that one product being short changes everything. Because from around that mid-90s, 96 era, right in there somewhere, when we went to Roundup Ready.
I was running a spray kit.
And I was a crop consultant.
And I couldn't believe I was spraying
Roundup. Exactly, because, you know, I graduated college in 95 and went to work as a crop consultant in that very next year. And from that time, really up until about, 2012, before Water Hemp and Palmer started showing up, it was it. I mean, it was Roundup Ready corn, it was Roundup Ready beans, Roundup Ready corn, you know, and so... The way we scouted fields changed, how we made recommendations, spray program recommendations changed, because really you had that security blanket and you didn't have to know every weed that was growing out there. You didn't, you know, because you could clean it up with Roundup. You could go over the top, clean it up. And so just that one product alone is a game changer. And I'll go ahead and throw this in here, too. In times such as these, having that good relationship with the person that you trade with, you know, where you buy your products, you know, I think that's an important thing to think about, because it allows you to start having those conversations about, hey, what are we going to do in 6 months when we're spraying over the top of our soybeans? Or, you know, so I think Roundup is definitely one that's got the attention of most everybody. In corn production, atrazine is really important. You know, it's consistent on weed control, and it has been one of the most cost-effective products that you can buy. The cheapest, and it's good. And it controls a lot of weeds. And, you know, I haven't heard a lot of rumors, but I have heard a few rumors that, you know, atrazine may be a little shorter. I don't think it's near to the limit of glyphosate, but there may be a little shortage, you know, more on that. You know, as you were talking about the fertilizer prices and kind of what's the game plan? Do we cut back? What do we do? And I think that's very interesting, because when, you know, on talking about dry fertilizer and shortages, that may very well be one that's everybody's going to get a little piece of the pie, because everybody's going to be cutting back because of the price of it. You're going to start really looking and putting a pencil to how much do I have to put down and still make a crop? Can I back off of what I've been doing? Instead of 400 pounds of 923.30, can I back that to even 200 or 300 or whatever? You know, those kinds of thoughts and those kinds of plans. And I think because of that, then you're going to start seeing that everybody's going to be able to get some dry fertilizer. Nitrogen, as you were talking about, it sounds like, after talking to some folks and doing some research, all forms of nitrogen is going to be short. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not just anhydrous. It's not just liquid. We all know that nitrogen is nitrogen is nitrogen. We know that. But all forms are going to be short, and what the price is going to end up being, none of us know. And so kind of going back, you know, I keep going back to what you were talking about, but it all ties together. Are we going to look at having to do a different form of nitrogen than what we've been accustomed to doing in the past? It may not be able to be status quo. So you might have to side dress and put it on pre-plant instead of pre-plant, but you might also have to use a different form of nitrogen than what you're used to, and be open to trying that. But we all know that may mean different equipment needs,
which could lead to
a whole nother.
Well, I think this is a time where producers are going to have to look at their crops on a field-by-field basis. Certainly, we know of areas that are more productive than others. There will be needs to really have a prescription, per se, about those inputs and what you're going to use on certain areas.
And I think the technology thing could be a big component to all of this and play a big part in it. If, you know, maybe if you're ahead of the curve and have some of this information or have some of this equipment to do that with, then that's great. But, you know, I'd say that's going to play a big component in what happens.
Well, the best thing is right now with all these issues so far is producers have options. They have the options of maybe cutting back on corn and maybe raising more beans. They have the options of looking at maybe some alternative forms of weed control. One thing with soybeans is you do have the option with some other chemistries that are out there not to have to rely on Roundup.
It's called going back to the 90s way of farming again.
Shh.
Back, you know, you said you was in a spray rig. I was making recommendations. And I'm sure you were, you know, Jay, you were working in it in one form or fashion.
I was in extension at that time. You know, I just had started.
You know, but back in the day.
Y'all keep saying that, and somebody's going to have a rope wick applicator drug out of the barn.
That's true. You never get rid of that stuff, Jay. Don't you know? You don't know when you're going to need it. But it is kind of interesting, though, to think that we're going – but when you think about this stuff, we are making full circle here because we are going to have to go back to more prescription type applications where it's boots on the ground. It is not having that safety net that I can clean it up. Like you said, David, it's going to be, I got to get out here and see what weed pressures I have and what products I can mix together. What kind of a spray program can I put together to control these weeds? Another thing is that may be hard for some people to, they may just not want to see it. We all know that there are some weeds that they don't compete. It's not a yield thing for us. So we may not have these clean bean fields. You may have a few weeds out there that you're just going to have to deal with. You're going to have some escapes because you're not going to be able to come over. But at the end of the day, you're not yielding. You're not reducing your yield potential because of that. So I think that's something, you know. But we are going back, and when you think about the prices, when you touched on that, you know, Roundup, you know, back in the 90s was, what, $75 a gallon or so?
Upwards, yeah.
Something like that. You know, last year you could buy it for $16, $17 a gallon. And what is it today? 60, 65? You know.
Yeah, the thing about it is relying on that to clean up your field was a great security blanket, and it probably spoiled folks.
It did.
Because you can just roll in there and just, you can clean it up, no problem. Some of these other chemistries, and some of them, Jay, is you know, some of those will be short too because of the manufacturing stuff. So we're going to have to figure out, we need a plan A, we need a plan B, we need several different plans to be able to control weeds and continue to get the yields we've been getting, those type things. So
putting a residual herbicide down is key because that gives you that early season control, and that's so important. And we had that.
Set crop ahead of.
And we had that prior to Roundup Ready. You didn't even think about putting something down that didn't have any residual to it until we had Roundup. And thank goodness those suppliers continued to make these products, even though we all know their sales were hurt.
Way down.
But they had the forethought to say, we're going to need these again. And thank goodness we still have those residuals because we've seen that in these Roundup-resistant weeds that we've had to deal with.
Well, and those chemical companies kept on making them because they had a market somewhere.
It
might not be in the U.S., but if you look at the European Union and some of the bans they've had on certain chemistries through the years, that's been the market for a lot of these other chemicals. And we'll probably see them come back. You know, if I was a producer right now today trying to plan my strategies, I'd be wanting, whether it's corn or soybeans, I'd be wanting to get myself to a situation to where I made it weed control wise till I had a good thorough crop canopy. And then I would assess and look at my plan B, David, or a plan C. It's not going to be one plan. I think it's going to be a variety
multiple.
Of plans.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think
right.
You're right. I think it'll be multiple plans that you have to, you know, and depending on the weather, depending on, you know, the weed pressures, how you attack those different fields and those type things. So I think you're right.
That's exactly right.
Well, that sounds good. Let's move along, and we'll move into my topic right now. And my topic for the week was foreign trade. I think anybody out there, Vicki, that's watched the news in the past 2 months has seen a spot where they've seen all those container ships sitting off the coast of California. We've all recognized that. We've heard the warnings on the news about, well, we're not going to have Christmas. You know, Christmas is going to be canceled because
they're all going to Florida.
I think a good portion of them are, and other ports around the country. But looking at that situation and looking at how we have the backlog of those items coming in, that's all part of our foreign trade. And when we think about foreign trade, we think about all those items that we import from other countries. We export a good amount of items too. And right now, if you look at the total amount of the export market, agricultural products amount for about 14% of all of our exports. To put that in dollar figures, what we're looking at for this year, for 2022, is somewhere around $177.5 billion. That's billion with a B, of agricultural exports. We have to look at these backlogs of these ships. We have to look at some of these things that are clogging up our ports. We have to look at the trucking that we hear so much about in and out of these ports, and realize that that's going to have some effect on our agricultural market as well. We're fortunate for the most part that the ports at LA do not move the vast majority of our agricultural exports. I saw a report just last week where the local city of Oakland has put a lot of money in renovating and opening up and retooling the Oakland ports there in San Francisco Bay. Originally, it was with the idea that they were going to be able to pull some of that backlog off of the southern part of the state, and it would be able to come in through Oakland. What they did is actually open up an export market for a lot of our beef. We've signed some new trade agreements with Japan that are going to allow a lot of our beef to move, and they're going to move out of that Oakland port because they have the availability on the West Coast, and that's important because that's where a lot of our beef goes. It goes to China, it goes to Japan, it goes to Southeast Asia in general, so we need to be on that side of the country. But when we look at our other ports, where other things go, the Port of New Orleans is where the vast majority of our grain leaves. And so obviously it's something that's not impacted by the backlog in LA, but you mentioned, David, earlier, Hurricane Ida. That's caused us a lot of problems.
And it tore up a bunch of stuff.
It tore up a lot of stuff. We're fortunate right now. We're at the time of the year. We're fixing to move into a new year. We're out of hurricane season. So hopefully that's going to be something that's not going to be an issue. But we just need to be cognizant of the fact that a lot of our trade does go to other countries. When you look at individual commodities, the vast majority of our exports are our grain crops. Whether they're grains and feeds or whether they're grains and oil crops, that they represent the vast majority of our agricultural exports. But right behind them is our agricultural and our livestock products. We are still at this point a net exporter when it comes to our total trade, but especially our agricultural trade. The only real area where we bring in a lot of agricultural products is in our horticultural products. That's flowers, that's citrus fruit, that's for the most part things that are grown in areas of the world that we just don't have the type of climate to support that type of production. We get a lot of products from South America. We get a lot of products from Mexico. We see a lot of flower production coming from those areas as well. So trade is one of those things that it's important. It ties directly into both of the topics that you two talked about today. We've got to have that shipping. We've got to have those open lines of availability and trade going back and forth. The real thought to me is to look at the countries that we're trading with and where the bulk of our products are going. I mentioned earlier that Japan and Southeast Asia is a big, big market for us. It's by far the biggest, with China being the largest. China's kind of a conundrum. They're the largest producer of so many items. They're the largest consumer of those items. They're the largest importer of those items. Look at tobacco, for instance. They're by far the world's largest tobacco producer, but they're the largest importer of tobacco products from other companies as well. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, you know, there for a while they were a big importer of pork because of the problems they were having in the swine industry over there, producing their pigs, and I think they're starting to get some of that straightened out. I've read a lot of literature and a lot of information about them building hog houses that are actually 6 or 7 stories, which is to me is pretty interesting, how they handle all the waste and all the different things. Yeah. So to me, that's really interesting. But, it's almost like a hotel for hogs. I mean, it's 6 or 7 stories tall. So they're doing some very innovative things. Their population is so large and their land mass is from a size standpoint is so small to be able to produce all these products close to those metropolitan areas. They're building up instead of out, so that's pretty interesting.
Land mass wise, they're less than 20% the size of Russia, their neighbor.
Right.
And lots more people.
Well, another thing that's interesting too is, talking about China, the active ingredients in a lot of our products that we used are derived in China. Now, they're manufactured over here, but the active ingredient is derived over there. And I think, an interesting thing that I found, read this week was that with back to the glyphosate and tying China together there is, of course, we all enjoyed the Olympics, the 2020 Olympics that was held in 2021 this year. But because of the Olympics, the production was stopped on that active ingredient for glyphosate and other products too, not just glyphosate. That production was stopped because with the Olympics, they have a lot of, when a site is determined, there's a lot of things that's got to happen behind the scenes to make sure of that everything's done to us. There's that committee. Yeah. But at any rate, just because of the pollution or scare of the pollution, then it was that production was shut down. And so you add that on top of the shipping issues trying to get things. I mean, it just kind of, like you said, it's all related. And I thought that was just very interesting when you were saying about China and everything they did, and there's so many things that we don't even think about or even know that their hand is in that directly affects a lot of people.
That's exactly right. So good discussion.
Also the whole China deal, which I mean that's kind of their big holdup on a lot of different products, is all the embargoes and the different things that the tariffs and the different things that they have against our products and we have against their products. And I mean that just it's a whole nother whole big bucket of stuff that just, we could dive into for days. But, and I think that hurts production, that hurts a lot of different things, and hopefully we'll be able to get some of that stuff worked out as we move along.
Absolutely.
Everything works better when everybody just tries to get along.
Right. So they tell me, Vicki, I don't have much experience at that.
That's what I've heard.
Well, let's move along. I think that's really good discussions. I hope as week to week as we travel through this thing that we can keep on having timely discussions like this. So let's move into our weekly topic. We're going to have a different topic every week that we kindly focus on. Some weeks we'll have guests and they'll be part of discussing that topic. But we picked something as our first topic to talk about that we all do on a regular basis, that's every extension office anywhere in any state is involved in, and that's soil testing. We're going to talk a little bit today about soil testing and why it's important for you and what necessarily you need to know about it. I guess the first thing really to know about what a soil test is, if somebody comes in and you make a recommendation that they need a soil test for a lawn or a garden or a crop field, pasture, you need to explain to them what exactly that is. And it's simply an analysis, a chemistry analysis, if you will, to make a baseline establishment of what nutrients are available in your soil. You'll take that baseline, and then you'll be able to write a recommendation upon that based upon what's already there and what its availability is. So keeping that in mind, it's almost... David, we talk about it a lot in the livestock world about balancing a ration, and that's really what we're doing in the soil situation is we're looking at what's available in that soil, and we're going to balance that recommendation with nutrients outside to amend it with.
Yeah, and I mean, the great thing about that, and of course, fertilizer prices are always an issue, but, you know, how important is having a soil test right now? Whether that's a crop field, whether that's a pasture, and for those homeowners, you know, your yard or whatever, how important is that to have that, to be able to amend that soil to where your crops are growing the most?
Sure. Going back to what we talked about earlier, this isn't the year to fly blind.
No, absolutely. And I think this probably, you know, soil testing this year probably as important, Mickey, as it's ever been. So, you know, hopefully folks will get out there and do that. And this is a great time to do that and figure out so you can make a plan. We talked about plan A, B, C, and D. But, yeah. You know, we need to definitely have a plan for what we're going to do from a soil testing standpoint.
And I think, too, if you think about it, you know, soil testing is kind of the foundation that you're going to build from. I mean, because if we're growing, I mean, if you're farming, you know, what regardless of it is, you're trying to grow something. I mean, you're either raising beef, you know, you're growing beef, so to speak, but you are also, I mean, you've got forages and you've got, you know, you're growing something. If you're raising corn and soybeans, wheat, tobacco, the list goes on and on and on. It doesn't really matter what commodity you're producing.
It's just you're producing
something. And you know, the soil itself, a lot of times we don't think about that. I mean, we put a lot of thought and effort and money into, you know, getting the right variety, and that is very important. It is very important. All of those are important, but your soil fertility and your, you know, soil health is also a very important piece of the pie, and a lot of times that really does get
left. And it can work for you, or it can work against
you. Or it can work against you, exactly. And sadly, it's one of those things that you really, some don't think about it until it is working against you, until something's happening and you know that you should be yielding more than this, or you know, you're noticing that the plant just doesn't look quite right. Something's going on. And so I think if we think about that, you know, that soil testing and getting that soil right, it makes for a strong foundation for whatever you're going to do outside of that. You know, it's not necessarily commodity specific. Now, the recommendations, Jay, like you were talking about, those are going to differ. The recommendations that we're going to get, and that's an important part when you think about when you're getting your soil samples, you need be thinking about that, because we need to know what was the previous crop, and we need to know what it's going into, because that is two important pieces of the pie that we need to know to be able to make those recommendations for what you do need to be able.
And yield information is a real important part of that. A lot of people don't give that, but that is kind of an important part.
That's right, David.
When you look at removal rates, you know, 100 bushel corn doesn't remove as much as 200 bushel corn. So you need to kind of, that all kind of plays into the whole
deal. Or 3,000 pound dark tobacco.
Right. It makes a big difference, you know, and part of what you get when you have a soil test is you get a pH. And you get that reading, and I'll say it, you know, lime is the poor man's fertilizer, and we may all be sitting trying to get lime trucks this year because fertilizer is so expensive. But if your pH is not right, the soil will certainly work, in that instance, will work against you.
I looked at a soil sample just last week that a guy brought in and wanted a little bit of advice on. Luckily for him, his P levels were actually high. His potash levels were fairly high. They were in the moderately high category. In a year like this, where those items are going to be expensive and hard to come by, that's a good thing. But the pH on that soil sample was 5.7. He's actually robbing himself a little bit of the availability of those two nutrients just by the fact that they're not going to be available to the crop.
It ties it up. If your pH is not right, it'll tie up the P and the K, and it will not let those nutrients be available to your crops.
So both on the high end, low end.
Yeah, either way, you get
too far out of whack. Either way, you're going to open yourself up to the availability of a lot of other nutrients there that you don't necessarily want, or elements. I think of manganese toxicity, for instance. I've seen a lot of that in dark tobacco through the years, and that's from a lower soil.
And, you know, and correcting that pH is the first thing we need to look at. I mean, when I look at a soil test, I don't know about you guys, but when one comes across my desk, my eyes go to the pH first. And it's not the first thing it's not the first thing listed, but that's the first place I'm going to go. Because, and then second place I'm going to go is, what crop are we raising here? Because, you know, really, aside from azaleas or blueberries, for the most part, and, you know, in this part of the world anyway, most everything wants an alkaline soil. You know, you're not, soybeans or any kind of legume is not going to do well in an acid soil, you know. And so I look at that first to see, you know, where we are, and then kind of go from there. And ironically, I've looked at a lot of soil tests over the years. But now I'm going to say I got one a couple weeks ago that has thrown me for a loop, and
We see lots of stuff too, Jay. I mean, that's the thing. We see lots of stuff that's different than most people. So go ahead, Vicki. I just want to preface what you're fixing to say with, I could write a book on some things that I've seen and people have.
Well, I get this soil test and I do like I always do what I just said. I always go to the pH first. Well, let's just say I haven't left the pH yet because it's 3.6. Have y'all had a soil test? I have never had one that low.
I'm kind of like Jay, about 5.5, 5.4 maybe.
My very first year of working, I had a 3.9. It was some plants, manganese toxicity issues, some tobacco plants that were carried into the lab. They were the little bit of residual soil around the roots, you know, that we used to have a lab technician that he always wanted a little bit of soil so he could do a quick pH test. It was low enough, he wanted me to pull an actual soil sample and have it run, so I went with the producer the next week to do that. 4.1 was what that actual sample was, and so... But that was going all the way back to 1996. I've not seen one that low.
Yeah, and the thing about it is at those levels, you can't put enough lime on to make that at one time.
Not in one year.
Or two.
Yeah, to make that where it'll, you know, come back into. So those are things that I like to tell people is we need to be building.
Yeah.
Those things. We need to build our pH level. We need to build our P and our K levels, you know, four times like this. That we've got really high fertilizer prices, that we can mine a little of that back, possibly. And then the lime, you know, that's poor man's fertilizer, however you want to look at it. But if the lime is not right, if the pH is not right, let me correct myself, pH is not right, your crops won't grow to be what they could be.
Won't reach their
right. You need to spend the money to correct the pH, is what you
know.
Before you do anything. And I'm going to go ahead and say this too. The sample is only as good as it was taken. Yeah. So there is a rhyme and a reason to taking a soil sample. And so when you start thinking about taking a soil sample, you need to, one, you know, you kind of do a zigzag pattern, because what you don't want to do is get in a straight line and you're right in the spreader track. And so every core that you're taking is right in that spreader track where the fertilizer was spread. On the opposite end of that, you don't want every one of them to be in the ditch either, so you really want to get a good representation of that field. And so you're going to take way more cores than what you're going to actually put in that bag or box to send off.
And you may want to break that up too,
Vicki, and you do.
If the field is so big, and we do have some rather large fields here.
That's right.
Kentucky, and believe it or not, for those folks that may be listening outside of Kentucky, in the western part of the state, we do have some rather large fields. So you may want to break that up a little bit.
What is the rule of thumb? About 20 acres, 20 to 30, 25 acres in a sample. Yeah. And so, you know, keep that in mind when you're taking your soil samples, but do that kind of zigzag pattern. Don't don't get in a straight line. Don't go diagonal. Don't make an X in the field.
Don't get it all on a hill ground. No. Don't get it all in a...
Don't, exactly. So really get a good sample. And I tell you what is also very key, and I think this is the part that sometimes I think we can see some errors in, is the depth of that soil, of that, that sample. Because within that soil profile, if you will, you know, the topsoil is where those nutrients are. That's what we're trying to test, because that's where that root zone is going to be more at, and what we're looking at for to pick up those nutrients. If you go deeper down in that soil profile and you're getting that subsoil, then your results are going to be skewed, because you're not going to have the nutrients. You're not going to that the subsoil is not what we're raising crops on. We're raising it on the topsoil.
Sure, we're feeding the roots of a crop. We're not feeding the soil necessarily.
Exactly.
We're feeding the roots of a crop, and those roots are going to be really maintained in that top 4 to 6 inches of a soil profile. One of the recommendations I've always made to people is when you're pulling that core, when you pull it in the ground, it doesn't really matter how far you put it in the ground. When you pull it out, take your hand and grab a hold of the bottom of the probe, and that's all the soil you need, is about the width of your hand. Anything above that, discard it and put the rest in the bucket to be mixed up for a composite sample.
And you'll notice a color change, too. If you get too deep, you'll be able to tell, you know, a color change in there. And I think those are just things to help you to get a good sample. I mean, it's a good, you want to, you know, it really just needs to be part of your management plan. You don't have to soil, there's really no need to soil test a field every year. The only time I would say that you would want to do something like that is if you are in a building stage and you just want to know where you are. Especially if we're looking at a pH, a low pH, and you're working on building that pH over time, because you can't put that much lime on at one time. And, you know, then you may want to sample every other year or something like that. But it's just important, I think, to keep that in your rotation. And then if you know, I've suggested to several people, you know, over the years, is just take your acres that you're growing, or it doesn't matter if it's livestock production or if it's grain production, but take your acreages, your farms, and maybe just divide that into thirds. And so, you know, 1 year you do this third, then, you know, the second year, you know, and then every 3 years or so, or you can do it in quarters if you want to do it in every 4 years, but kind of divide that up, but you're getting some soil samples every year, you know, and get that in your, you know, and get
that. Unless P and K are $800-$900 a ton.
Then you're going to
want to do it every year.
You're going to do it every year. And that's what I was going to say. But this is the year. It doesn't matter if you took them last year. This is the year to get them.
But in general, I agree with Vicki wholeheartedly, you know, but unless fertilizer prices are,
and you're exactly right, David,
you're going to have to do it this year. I mean, there'd be no sense not to.
That is
the cheapest way to make an impact on your bottom line this year, is to take a soil test. I mean, it's the cheapest thing you can do. It's $8, $9, $10, whatever it is, $12, whatever it is. I mean, that can affect a lot of acres on your farm and a lot of money that you, if you just take one sample, say, I'm going to go by last year's. You may not need, you know, P and K. What were your removal rates? What all of those type things. That all factors into, and that's bottom line. That's going to be real important. If you don't know your cost of production this year, you're in trouble.
And you mentioned, you know, what that yield. That is important, because those recommendations that we're going to make are based upon the yield potential. And yes, I know that everybody wants to have farms that produce 250 bushel of corn every year, 70 bushel beans every year, you know, just outstanding, you know, hay. And, you know, just incredible yields on anything. But we also know that's not true. Not every field has the same potential. And you know your history. You know within a few bushel about what the yield potential is for every farm that you farm. And you need to base what fertilizer you're going to spread and what, you know, and that needs to be known on those soil when you do the paperwork for that soil test, because that is key to reducing some of those input costs that you're going to put as far as fertilizer?
In the past, I'm as guilty as anybody, but in the past, in the spring, even if I had a soil test or didn't have a soil test, I would put on P and K and nitrogen for hay fields. Just about every one of them is the same, completely the same. This fall, after I heard that fertilizer prices were going to be at what they were, we went on and put P and K on our hay fields and our pastures this fall. I soil tested every field, and I had probably, instead of having one or two blends, I probably had 9 or 10. So I think it's real important on a field-by-field basis, on a case-by-case basis, you've got to pinch every penny that you can pinch, and that's going to be a way to do that. And I mean, it's going to be kind of a pain for the ag-retail folks.
It is, and they're going to fuss kind of growl a little
and
bit.
Growl, but you know what? It's not their bottom line. It's your bottom line.
I bet they want you back as a customer next year, too.
That's right.
and not so much from a standpoint of them not doing what you want, but you want to stay in business. And this is going to help you do that.
But I will say, too, and you probably noticed, or be interesting, let me ask you, when you did that on a field-by-field basis, though, but weren't you able to kind of group
yes.
some? So you could, you know,
but you may have to have drove.
That's right.
To get from
yeah,
one
but,
field
you
to the other,
still
but you can
group.
Still group.
You're
absolutely.
Not. You're not. You didn't have something for 10 acres, you know. And so I think you can. You can. You know. You can group those together because you will be able to find some that you.
Oh
can
yeah,
group
and I had that same thing. I took 25 or 6 samples, and I think we had probably 12 or 14 different blends that we ended up doing. So it's not as bad as you might would think it would be. But it's still, it's not what they're used to, the ag retail folks.
And you may just need to go ahead and plan, too, for when they're going to come out and spread it for you. You just stay with them.
Yeah.
Because that's going to ensure that blend is going to go to the right field. Because from an ag retail standpoint, I can feel for them. When we know exactly what field we're talking about, we think we're explaining it to a T.
In detail,
that there is no way that you can spread fertilizer in the wrong field, but I will tell you from experience,
it happens a lot.
So just go ahead when you're going to have several blends, and I promise you that retail location and that spreader truck driver will appreciate that, and they're going to remember that you did that.
So soils maps and VRT has helped a lot with that, but it's certainly not eliminated.
That's right. And you know, we pull off the Google Earth, we pull off the map of the field or whatever, and that's helpful too. In a lot of different aspects, but like Vicki says, if you're there with them, that helps a lot. Whether that's opening gates and making sure they get in the right field, or not,
or the right farmer
even. So you know, a lot of those things kind of take place and are very helpful for sure.
Sounds good. Well, we've had a very healthy discussion, I think, on soil testing, something we think is very important. I think we all can agree that the bottom line is this is the year. If you do it every few years, this should be the year. Even if you did it last year, this would be the year to follow up and soil test. And I think it'd be a wise decision for anybody, regardless of the crops that you produce. So let's move along into our timely tips. This is something we're going to do every week that we feel like is just a quick tip. It's something that's timely. It's for that time of the year that producers should be thinking about. So, David, what's your tip of the week?
Well, mine's kind of a 3 or 4-fold tip of the week. Goes back to all the discussion we've been having today, you know, about fertilizer prices and different things of this nature. We need to think outside the box. About when we even plan to make a purchase or you know, for the inputs for the crop year. Do we want to put down P&K right now? I guarantee you that if your ag retailer has P&K in the bin, he'll sell it to you right now. And my guess is it'll be just a tick cheaper than what it will be this spring. So you may want to think about doing that, whether that's pasture or corn or beans or whatever. If you can get over the field, I think it's a good time to do that. Use side dressing as an option or in-furrow row application to put down fertilizer, and you need to know your cost of production. I think this year, amongst all the other years, folks always ask them, you know, what their cost of production is. Well, I don't really know. This is going to be a time that we need to know. We definitely need to know what our cost of production is, especially with fertilizer prices the way they are.
Vicki, how about you?
Well, my timely tip is for this time of year is, you know, we get out of the field and sometimes we just step away and we don't think about some things, but everybody needs that break. So while you're taking that break, just go ahead and get your private applicator license out, or if you're a commercial applicator, get that out and just take a look on when that expires. Those licenses, at least in Kentucky, are good for 3 years. And they expire on the last day of that third year of your certification. So check that out and see, because if yours is set to expire on December 31st of 2021, you need to be on the lookout for when those trainings are going to be able to get your certification again, because you will not be able to purchase restricted use pesticides without it, and you won't be able to apply them, restricted or general use for that matter. And that could be big this year. So just take a moment, look at that, and make sure that you're on top of that, and make sure you get those renewed if you need to.
Sounds good. Well, my tip of the week is going to be for our livestock producers, predominantly our beef producers, but that's to pay attention to where our winter hay feeding areas are. We've had a really, really good pasture year. For the most part, statewide, we've had good pastures, and I think a lot of that started and goes back to last winter. We didn't have a very, very wet winter. We had moisture, but it wasn't excessive, and our pastures didn't get treaded in. Our areas where we fed hay didn't get tore up quite as bad as they have in the past or in those wet years. So I think that helped us kind of develop a pasture system along through the summer that worked well for everybody. We had good production, and it paid us well. Going into this time of the year, we don't know yet what kind of moisture we're going to be looking at. It could be an extremely wet year. So I say pick those winter hay feeding areas. Make sure you're feeding hay in an area that is a little drier, that's not going to get treaded up quite as bad. That'll be an area that you won't have to spend as much on fixing and reseeding come springtime. So that's kind of my timely tip.
That's a good one, too.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
I think they were all good.
Sounds good. Well, we just want to make sure, again, to thank everybody for joining us. Thanks, David. Thanks, Vicki, for this week's information. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.